You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 50 for May 2017. 50 shows, 50 times.
That's a long time. I can't believe it's been 50 months that we've been doing this.
I know. Yes, 50 times we've been doing this. And what, 50 actually plus three? They did the two or three proto shows before we actually did it.
That is true.
This is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. Visit our website, centersteer.com, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's show. We are also part of the 4x4 Radio Network. I invite you to check out their shows at that are also 4x4 related at 4x4radionetwork.com. There's a show dedicated to our cousins, the Jeeps. And I remind you that June is Jeep Month. At least I'm declaring it Jeep Month because that's in June. In Butler, Pennsylvania, which is not far from podcast headquarters, is where Jeeps started. And they have the Jeep Jamboree. Takes place the first full weekend or second weekend, June 9th through the 11th, whatever that weekend is, in Butler, PA. And they have a full Jeep Jamboree thing. They have off-road trials. They've got camping, and they've got a parade and all that. As we all know, if you've listened to the show long enough, you do know that Jeeps are the cousins, the forefathers in many ways of Land Rover. Without Jeep, there would be no Land Rover. The 4x4 Radio Network has a show for you, for the Jeepers. I want to thank you for your comments, follows, and likes on Facebook, Twitter, and email, and a special thanks to our Patreon subscribers. And you want to visit patreon.com/centersteer for all those details that if you wish to make a monthly contribution, and you get some special stuff that happens, such as advanced notice of guests, and you get to ask, sometimes I'll ask if you have a question, and I can pass it along to our guest. Last time I sent out pictures that Martin had provided us and gave them to our show, to our Patreon subscribers in advance so they could see some of those. So try to do some interesting things for our Patreon folks as I can. 3 minutes into the show, and I'll finally tell you that I'm your host, John Kostich, and joining me from Western Pennsylvania is not Harold. Harold is still working on my truck, and we'll get to that in a minute. But also joining us from the Green Mountain State. Is it green still?
It is green. It is absolutely green. Getting plenty of rain and alternating with some nice warm weather as well. So the greenery is certainly exploding around here.
Is it always green?
Except for, 6 months of winter.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if there was ever a lot of evergreens in Vermont.
Yeah, we have lots of evergreens.
Okay. And his name's Morgan, by the way.
Yes, I'm Morgan from Vermont.
That's Morgan from Vermont. What are you driving these days?
Actually, pretty much nothing right now. I'm in between vehicles.
The disco's down, the Volvo's down.
Yeah, they're both down.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, that's the way it goes.
And indeed it does. Indeed it does. Our guests this month are four, in fact. We have four guests this month. They are all from Texas Rovers. I attended SCAR back in April, and I talked about the event on our last show. But this month, we have two interviews conducted on-site, first with Chris and Kevin talking about Texas Rovers Club and the SCAR event itself, and the second is with Sarah and Laura talking about Barbara Toy and the tribute run that is in her name, Barbara Toy. So those are coming up later in the show. And before we get to the news, I want to update you on my Continental Overland trip that I'm planning for the summer. As many of you probably know, I turned 50 this summer, and I wanted to drive around the continent, North America continent to be specific, and visit things I've never been to, things I've been to before and want to see again, and visit friends, family, and breweries, because, why not? Breweries are cool. and take my imported Defender 110. The is closer to being done. It is not complete, but the plan these days is it should hopefully be complete at the end of June, and then I'll probably leave mid-August on my trip. So that's the update on the trip. As you guys probably know, if you listened to the show long enough, here in Pittsburgh, there's the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix, and over the years, I've expanded to have more and more events throughout the entire month, not just the races and the car show that takes place like on the third weekend in July. I think it's the third weekend. But they have other events, and so I'd like to attend as much as possible those with the new truck, or at least updated, rebuilt truck.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
But that's also why Harold's not here, because Harold's working feverishly on the truck. Although today is Indy 500, so it's his high holy day. I'm sure he took the day off to watch the Indy 500. I mean, I watched that for a few minutes. Have you seen the race lately?
I haven't. No.
I like racing, but it's not like in my blood as much, I guess, as it is for other people. And I'll watch it occasionally, but it's not something I typically watch. But as I was prepping for the show, I was watching the Indy 500. And they now have all these cameras on the cars, which is interesting to begin with. But they have numbers now on the side of the car. And you can see in real time as that car gets passed, the position changes. So it'll say, 13 and then 14. And if the car goes into the pit, like you can see, it'll go 13, 15, 16, 17, 20, 22, 25. And, they're only in the pit for 30 seconds, but you can see they drop 10 spots and it's right on the side of the car. And then they have they'll have an accident. They have a really bad one, like in the last maybe 10 minutes of the race. The last 10 laps, I think. As soon as the car's like, it knows a car had an accident or a crash or is crashing, these red lights start moving on where instead of the number, they make a little like motion and then they go green. And then when the car's dead and stopped, the light goes out. It's like a video game. It was kind of really strange.
Interesting.
I have to say I didn't like it. It was just like I could see have the number. And then if there's an accident, just make it go all red so people know that it's a problem, but it almost seemed like gamification, if I can use that, for the Indy 500.
And now I'm curious how they actually implemented this. Is this, do you think the numbers on the sides of the cars are actually changing, or is this something they're like digitally superimposing on the video in real time? Sort of like, the yard lines in football games, all those, they're not really there, like the ball position.
No, this looks legit, actual LEDs on the side of the car. There's right behind the drivers that hump that then slopes down behind the driver, I guess, for to give them like a rollover protection. And there's looks like a GPS antenna on top of that, but then right below all that on that tunnel portion is LED display, and you can see it. And as you can see, as the vehicles go around the track or they're stopped in the pit, it doesn't look superimposed.
That's cool.
Well, cool.
I mean, they're always trying.
Yeah, but I don't like the way they implement it. Doesn't seem appropriate for a race with human lives in play. Just didn't seem
so
right
true.
That's Indy 500, and this is not the Indy 500 podcast. This is the Center Steer podcast that we should talk about Land Rovers.
Sounds good. Have we ever talked about Land Rovers before?
49 times.
Okay. Yeah.
Well played, sir. We didn't even plan that one. Well played. Jag Land Rover sales dropped 4.4%. I don't even know where I see the 4 from. It says right here in the headline, it dropped 2.3% in April. Now, that was globally. So this is for Tata from, is the owner of JLR these days. Jaguar sales were up, though, and Land Rover was down a bit. So Jag was up because of the F-Pace and the new XE. The F-Pace being their compact SUV, which doing some research, which we'll get to this later in the news, but it's interesting how Jaguar calls the F-Pace the compact SUV. Land Rover sales were down a bit, and they think that's because there's a change in the laws, change in taxing in the UK starting in April, so folks were buying before the sale. I think taxes went, or we're not buying because I think taxes maybe have dropped or something. It was unclear exactly what the change was. I'm sorry. In the UK, customers purchased vehicles before the increase in vehicle tax on April 1. So that was okay. So there was there was an increase. And then also they think Disco 4 was running out. And so they were not obviously producing a lot of them. So there wasn't as many Discos on the floor to sell because the Disco 5 comes out here in this month of May. I guess kind of to be expected for overall.
Yeah, that all makes sense.
And then specifically in the U.S. for JLR sales, they were actually better overall for Land Rover. Jaguar sales were up 197% in April, between April of this year and April of 2016. They sold 1,087 units, which for them is nearly 200% increase. Land Rover sales were up slightly. They sold 5,200 units for the month. So things are doing well. I think that's basically what that means. And it seems like a natural progression as they're changing models. Things are kind of stagnant here or lower here. No worries there, I think. But this does highlight the F-Pace being Jag's big seller. And Mototrend had an interesting article that I thought we should spend a few moments on called Jaguar and Land Rover's Tricky Balancing Act, The Big Picture. And it talks about, the difference between Jag and Land Rover and the not difference between the two. Jag has traditionally been a sports car and sports sedan mark, and Land Rover, as we know, is kind of SUV off-roading capability. And then Jag came out with the F-Pace, which is selling great, and it seems to have helped them out immensely. As you can tell, sales have been up like bonkers. And it's almost like what Cayenne did for Porsche, F-Pace seems to be doing for Land Rover. As the article states here, becoming a juicy cash cow that can be milked to fatten profits and fund the development of future Jaguars. Which, unfortunately, was hoping Harold would be here to because we know his interest in as being a Jag fan and what that means, and his thoughts on it. But it's interesting. It's still something interesting to note. And other people are taking note, of course, is that there's this Jaguar and Land Rover going to have to balance this.
And on the just on the F-Pace side, I think it's 40% of Jaguar sales last year was the F-Pace. So that's a huge chunk. It really is that cash cow for them.
Oh, absolutely. And and they've come on, which, it's the good and the bad. As Harold, I think, would say is, well, that's not what they were started to be or what they're about. But on the good,
I think he would say that they have no place making an SUV.
Okay. You're right. Why are you doing this? You're right. But on the good side, it gives them that money that will allow them to continue to produce sport cars, sports sedans, which are, this is not just Jag's problem. This is a worldwide problem that sport car sedans in particular are not selling well around the world. And that was noted here in the article that the sedan segment, who is this? JLR Global Sales Chief Andy Goss says that the sedan segment in every market in the world is under enormous pressure. So, having an SUV is like, that's where you need to be because that's where you're going to make your money and then allows your brand to continue. I wonder if they hadn't done the F-Pace, would Jag really continue? I mean, that's really has to be asked.
Yeah. And, historically they've been, they like making sports cars, but they relied on sedans for all their profit.
Right.
But that's just not a profit center anymore.
That's an excellent point.
Where else do you move? It's SUVs.
That's an excellent point. I hadn't thought of it that way. You're right. Sedans were their profit center. And then now that sedans are under pressure, then you need to move to where you can make the money to and obviously do the fun stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, even Bentley's now building an SUV, right? They've seen the pressures and they need to do that. The F-Pace itself is a shared platform with the new Land Rover Velar, which I think gave Land Rover the option then to have the Velar, which I think probably they might not have done without that chassis, I think. Would you agree with that?
I would, yeah. I think this is, well, obviously it was something that they built for the F-Pace first, and they just sort of decided, well, this would be a really good platform. I think that there's a fair amount that is similar between the two, the Velar and the F-Pace. And obviously the Velar is not out yet. It's just announced. I think, what was it, Angus McKenzie of Motor Trend wrote that the F-Pace rides high, wide, and handsome for a Jaguar, and the Velar is the lowest, sleekest Land Rover in history. I kind of like that quote, but it really shows, even though for the individual marks, that they're a fairly different vehicle from their norm. Yeah, I mean, it's the same platform. They're sort of converging there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good point. We did some research, which is, I think, a first. It's taken us 50, 50 episodes. We finally did some research before the show began. We were talking about the story and just kind of comparing the sizes of the Range Rover Sport, the Velar, the Evoque, the Disco 5, and the Disco Sport. I won't go through it all, but this is all from North America spec stuff. Yeah, the wheelbase for most of these are all together, close together. As you would expect the Range Rover Sport, the Velar, and the Disco 5 to all be similar. And they are. They're 115 or 113 inches, the Velar being the shortest. It's 2 inches shorter, which makes sense that it would be based off of the F-Pace chassis. The Velar is long as all the other Range Rovers. It's at 189 inches, and the regular Range Rover's 197, the Range Rover Sport's 191, the Disco 5 is 196. So, you know, it's in there. But here's the interesting one, and I know we even double-checked our numbers here for this one. The Velar, its width is almost 2 feet narrower than a Range Rover. Range Rover is 81.6 inches wide, and a Velar is supposed to be 64.7 inches wide. Is my numbers right? Is that almost 2 feet? The Evoque.
Yeah.
And it's even narrower than an Evoque. An Evoque is 78 inches wide, which is actually, an Evoque is 3 inches narrower than a full-size Range Rover.
And I think we did all of those measurements with the mirrors folded in, correct?
That's right.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Velar has a lot of new interesting features, and they're really shooting for aerodynamics with both the F-Pace and the Velar. So I have a feeling that that is a really large factor there, because for aerodynamics, one of the most important things is sort of your frontal area. And if you're trying to make an SUV, there's only so far you can go in reducing the height of the front of the vehicle. But, you know, making it a significantly narrower vehicle is going to cut down that area significantly as well. Yeah, it's very interesting. And also the Velar has a lot of things like all the, you know, the door handles sort of go flush with the vehicle when you're driving. I don't know if they're doing similar things with the mirrors, that they can actually fold in narrower than the standard Range Rovers and the Range Rover Sport. Very interesting, though, that it can be that much slimmer than the other models.
Yep, absolutely. Back to the kind of balancing act between Jag and Land Rover, I think that's very indicative of the fact that the Velar pops in kind of out of nowhere, really, and is noticeably different, I think, than the rest of it. And it's only because of, you know, I think Jag coming up with its own chassis for the SUV, and then they're like, oh, well, we can use that for this kind of special case. The Velar definitely seems to me to be a special case, almost a statement, you know, of what can be done versus what should be done.
Yeah, and it also seems like a statement of this is where we want to go. At least if you listen to Jerry McGovern, obviously right. That is where he wants to go. But yeah, it's interesting that that's sort of the probably what we'll see more of,
yeah,
whether we like it or not.
indeed. But interesting article. You might want to read it yourself and see what you think about where, you know, this is maybe a defining point about where both marks are going. Maybe it says nothing. Maybe it's just the natural inevitability of if you want to continue to make vehicles, you have to come up with an SUV. I mean, maybe that's what this boils down to, because that's what people are buying. And, you know, and you put your name on it, and then you make your special statement to it. I mean, that was the other thing. I think of it in this article was that I think the F-Pace being the SUV, JLR is going to make something special for Jaguar and let them do the all-electric version of it. So I think the first all-electric JLR vehicle is going to be, I think they call it, is it the I-Pace? Or is that, no, the I-Pace is a smaller one, isn't it?
That is their concept vehicle. So that is their concept all-electric Jaguar SUV, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember. We should do more research again. But I know, heaven forbid we do research. Little other side note to all this, just because I wanted to mention it. I end up looking at the Jag XE, not in person, but online. And the XE is their compact sports sedan, which I keep mentioning the word compact because I find it interesting that Jag keeps calling this stuff compact. Like the SUV is a compact SUV, which makes you, I know, I'm even off more topic again. Sorry, guys. F-Pace being a compact SUV, does that mean there might be a non-compact SUV for Jaguar later? Will that compete with full-size Range Rover? Yeah,
Don't tell Harold.
That explains why he's not here. He's crawl back a little bit myself from a divergent path here and come back to the Jag XE, which is their compact sports sedan. I guess would that be competing with the BMW 3 Series or 1 Series? I'm not as versed on the BMWs.
Yeah, that I'm not sure.
Nice looking car. The interesting thing that stood out for me was like, they have an all-wheel drive diesel model.
That's awesome.
That was, yeah, exactly. Like, all-wheel drive diesel, and it says 42 miles of the gallon. Now, it's a $1,500 premium to purchase the diesel over the gasoline engine. But the here in America, the gasoline, premium level gasoline, which is required for the Jaguar, is more expensive than diesel. And so they estimate that it would take about a year and a half before you would recoup that premium that you paid for the diesel engine. Like, I know, as someone who has a diesel Jetta that he likes, but, you know, if maybe, you know, that could be a nice replacement for the diesel Jetta that I want to keep but may not be able to.
It's not that divergent, though.
Now, it would, you know what would make it real tough, though, Morgan, is if they came out with the diesel Disco Sport here in the U.S., I'd have a role. That would probably make me turn in my Jetta. I think that might do it.
Yeah, that would do it for me if I were in your situation.
Just because it would, like, okay, it's, you know, probably gonna be about, well, probably should be about the same price as the XE sedan, but, you know, it's a Land Rover. Check it out. That's about the right size for me. It's the right form factor for me because I need to haul some things occasionally. I go camping or I haul kegs for the brewery, you know, those kinds of things. So it's the right case for me. Plus, I take the odd trip now and again in a nice vehicle that doesn't beat you senseless. I'm looking at you, 109. I am looking at you. Oh, I'm sorry. I am looking at the 109, but yeah. Man. Okay. Anyways, we're getting really divergent on these things, aren't we?
But yeah, I think that actually fits in really well with our next story, which is regarding Land Rover and, well, JLR specifically, sticking up for diesels, where there's, you know, everybody seems to be coming down hard on diesels, especially after the Volkswagen issue.
Cheating, liars. They're liars. Cheating,
lying, cheating.
And wasn't there something in the news this week? I meant to note the story. Was it BMW and Chrysler and Fiat having a similar, there was somebody said that they may have also cheated on their big ones too, the big full size Cummins diesel numbers. I thought I saw some story about that.
You know, I missed that, but the Morton. Volkswagen stuff was all Bosch, and I would be surprised if BMW was not using Bosch for a lot of their systems.
No, it definitely was Bosch, because I know Bosch is, I got a separate notice about Bosch settling, you know, as part of their case. Yeah, so in the story, Ralph Spaeth, who's the JLR boss, says, "Stop being so mean to diesels." But you're, as you said, you know, Volkswagen has given everybody a black eye, and I think that's the way the article reads, and I think what he's getting after is it was a Volkswagen gave you some European cities and countries the opportunity to clamp down on diesels, and I think they're using that as an opportunity to do that. And what is it, Paris, Berlin, Athens, they're planning to ban the technology completely, I believe, and what, London has announced plans to levy a stiff charge on anyone driving a diesel-powered vehicle through central areas of the capital starting in early 19, adding fuel to the anti-diesel fire. Well, okay, you knew that already. Yeah, there's none of that here in the U.S.
Then again, diesels are, aside from a few marks like Volkswagen and Mercedes and just a few others, diesels have not been particularly popular here. They're only just gaining traction.
Well, not in the passenger or car segment, certainly.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. I think Jeep came out with one of their the Renegade, one of their newer ones. I think you can now get that Jeep diesel.
Yeah, there's a lot of diesel options on the market now. You know, the usuals, Ford, GM, all of those, but Jeep is adding to that. Yeah, there's a lot of diesel options. Finally.
And then Volkswagen gives everybody a black mark on the whole thing. Yeah, exactly. Well, at least Land Rover is continuing as to support diesels, and also especially, and they have reaffirmed to bring diesels to the United States, and they continue to do that. And as we saw in the last couple of months, they've sold very well here in the U.S., the Range Rover diesel, Range Rover Sport diesel, and I believe the new Disco 5 is going to have a diesel option. At least that's certainly would be a hope.
Yes, it does have a diesel option.
Now, if they would only do the Disco Sport diesel, then I'd have a real problem.
Right. You would have way too many JLR diesel options.
Yeah,
that'd be a great problem.
No, it is a great problem. I can keep my entire fleet diesel. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Ralph Spaeth actually said, I think it was, quote, "The latest diesel technology is really a step in emissions performance particulates. It's better for the environment when compared to an equivalent petrol engine. diesel has to, it needs to have a future. And I think that's really important that he's standing up there and saying all this, because the media certainly is, well, as we said, Volkswagen was, it was an easy target to target diesel after Volkswagen. And of course, the media is really good at going and pulling stock footage of, you know, 80s diesels just burning coal and
belching,
you know,
smoke. And, and they were terrible. They were terrible.
They were absolutely terrible. But the new ones are really good. You know, CO2 levels with diesel, our output is significantly lower by orders of magnitude than gasoline. And with all the modern cleaning, they're able to get rid of particulates and a lot of the sort of acid rain creating output from the exhaust as well. Yeah, well, one other thing that Spaeth said is that ICE to ACE, which is internal combustion engine cars to autonomous connected electrified ones, will happen in parallel. So there's no switch. You can't say diesel will go in 2020. You need to develop both internal combustion diesel and petrol engines in addition to battery electric vehicles, which that's another, you know, very important truth that he's standing up and saying. This technology, it's better than gasoline right now. And it's not like we can just cut a switch and suddenly all the diesels and all the gas engines go away and we have just everybody driving electric vehicles. That's not how it works. And I think JLR is planning like 25-30% of their vehicles to be fully electric by 2025. And in the meantime, half of them they're shooting for having at least a hybrid or electric option, so some amount of electric power in there by 2020. So, you know, they're already a pretty good company in terms of doing really efficient diesels at this point. And, you know, it's not going to change overnight.
I was at an event yesterday and I met a service tech at a Tesla dealership. It was very exciting.
Very cool.
Yeah, I didn't talk much. I just said, like, oh, he wore, well, the guy wore a Tesla shirt. And I was like, oh, do you own, work, or interested? And he goes, oh, I'm in tech there. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. You know, that was it.
Very nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I still want to see somebody take the Model X off-road.
Hell yeah. Right. We'll do it here at the podcast. If you have a Model X and you wish to take it off-road, we'll be happy to help.
Absolutely.
JLR faces a loss of aid for Slovakia car plant. We've talked in the past about the Land Rover, I think, in particular, looking to build a plant in Europe, specifically in Slovakia. And the thought might be that they were going to build the new Defender there or parts of it. It would reduce their costs. But apparently they might lose some of the incentives they were getting from the state. I think that's Europe, not Slovakia in particular, to build a plant there. And I think it's related to Brexit. I wish I could tell you more, but you only get to read that Financial Times article once and then the paywall kicks in. I'm like, well, so screw it. That's I'm just reading you the headline at this point.
Yeah, and you know, it's not like we have all that many details on any of those goings on anyway.
Right. Sorry about the mic bump there. On interesting news, I'm surprised no one has done this before department, Land Rover is patenting an automatic load space covering device. Cover that you pull over in the boot or in the trunk to cover your purchases. Apparently they're working on an automatic one, which, again, surprised no one else has done that before, but apparently Land Rover's working on a patented one.
And it makes sense. You can remotely, through an app on your phone, fold up and down all the seats on the Discovery 5. And, so
yeah, you push.
You know, why not be able to hide your shopping?
You can wave your foot and open up the tailgate. Why not? Yeah, why not
right.
have that cover? Yeah, so
absolutely.
Why not? And I'm sure Harold would complain. Another thing to go wrong.
Well, and those things break all the time anyway. So good luck with making that reliable.
I just worry, like, if you have something too tall in there and then your kid hits the button, you know, and it goes, yeah, is it? Of course, I'm sure it's.
Or you have kids riding in the back.
Or kids. Wow! Mommy!
Well, maybe it's a good way to automatically shut up your kids on long car trips.
Land Rover has launched the marketing campaign for the new Disco 5 here in the U.S. The one thing that I thought was, we know they're good at marketing, and so they're ramping up the marketing for the new Disco. It's now available. It's rebranded. Actually, we should mention that. It's being back to its original name here in North America, the Disco, not the LR4 or what would have been called the LR5. So welcome back. Actually, that's what they should have called it. They should have called us. It should be Welcome Back Discovery. That would have been a better name than the new Discovery, right?
I agree, yeah.
But they're ramping that up. Anthony Bourdain's, I guess, first time ever, he's having a vehicle, and it's going to be spot. And they're going to give him a vehicle, so it'll be on his show, Parts Unknown, on CNN. Basically, all it boils down to, new Disco available in the U.S. again under the Disco name, and it starts at $49.9.
Well, they've actually got some other interesting things going on. They did a 30-second television spot to launch it with the Ben Isley Racing sailing team. So it's kind of interesting. And I think they're also, in addition to Anthony Bourdain's show, they're doing some kind of Travel Channel show with Josh Gates on some kind of quote-unquote live journey exploration in the Discovery. So interesting. Just a bunch of stuff there they've got lined up in the queue right now.
You can buy the first edition of the new Disco 5. That doesn't start at $49.9. I'm looking at the website right now. That starts at $73.9.
Ooh, ouch.
21-inch wheels, black grille, black surround, body color door handles, LED lights with LED signature, and auto high beam assist, power fold, heated mirrors with approach lights, surround camera. Which, okay, that sounds actually pretty cool. It's around camera system. Power gesture tailgate, power sunroof, Windsor leather seats, Meridian sound, 10-inch touchscreen, InTouch ProNav system, heated and cooled front and rear seats, configurable ambient interior lighting, intelligent seat fold, activity key, terrain response, that's two, all-terrain progress control. What's all-terrain progress control? That's a new one.
Yeah, that I'm not sure. That's a good one.
It's all-terrain.
Does it tell you how far on the trail you are?
Of course. I just wanted to see if they had diesel. I hadn't checked that before to see if their diesel was an option for the new D5. And come back.
I think it is, but I don't know about in that first edition.
Evoque celebrates its sixth year with a special edition model.
I can't believe that's been 6 years already. Seems like just yesterday we started talking about that.
Yeah, well, and it was probably 2 years before that while they were talking about and ramping up the model. So it's been
right.
And they're starting to work talking to a new replacement of Evoque, right? New updated edition, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they are. And for this, they actually decided to launch a Land Rover Evoque Landmark edition. So they actually have an edition that's specifically for the 6 year anniversary. It's mostly a new moraine blue paint color, which is, supposed to be inspired by the turquoise lakes of the Canadian Rockies, and a whole bunch of, similar to that initial release of the Disco 5. They've got 21-inch rims, all sorts of crazy interior trim, and 4G Wi-Fi hotspot, and all sorts of stuff. But surprisingly, the Evoque is actually their most decorated model ever. I think it's won like 200 awards since it went on sale in 2011.
Nice. I do like the color. That is a sharp color. I don't know if I'd want it all the time, but it's sharp color.
Yeah, I like it too. It's not the same, but it reminds me of Volvo's Polestar Blue. Polestar was their racing team.
Are they doing this in their convertible edition? Do you know?
My research didn't show whether it was convertible option as well. It seemed like it was sort of a standard, but
I think it was
that would be cool in a convertible.
I think that would be, that'd be killer. Yeah. Well, maybe when, let's see, well, they didn't start the convertible edition until, 3 years in or 4 years in? So maybe in 4 or 5 years, they'll have the convertible landmark edition up.
Exactly. Will it come in like a sunburned pink?
Can't waste an opportunity to market and take people's money, right?
Yeah.
in North America, they marked the 30th anniversary of the Range Rover, because even though the Range Rover debuted in 1970, it wasn't available in the United States until 1987. Land Rover North America brought together I assume it can't be all of them, because I don't think they're all still around. At least I know one's not around. 36 of the original dealers that started Land Rover North America, which actually at the time was called Range Rover North America. They didn't change that until years later. Brought them all together, took them to New York, gave them a show and a drink, and took them around in new Range Rovers and showed off what it was. So that was good for them. I think it's nice when they celebrate the heritage.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was an interesting sort of celebration and thank you event for them. And after they had, you know, the show and a fancy dinner in New York, they took them all to Central Park for a photo shoot. And I think they brought along an original 1987 Range Rover Classic from their Heritage collection.
As they would.
As well as a 97 Defender D90. And I think one of the Land Rover Discovery Trek vehicles as well.
Yeah.
So kind of cool to do that as well to commemorate it.
Yeah, good for them. And a little interesting note, they see back in 87, 36 retailers, they sold 2,586 new Range Rover vehicles. That was all of 1987. They sold 2,500 vehicles, all of 87, excuse me. Comparing that to 2016, where Range Rover sales alone for the calendar year of 2016 totaled 48,000 vehicles.
Yeah, I think it's actually almost 49,000. It was like 48,800.
Yeah, good for them. Well done. And that's, of course, you know, now they, you know, back then it was, they sold the Range Rover. Now they sell Range Rover Sport, Range Rover Evoque.
And I think they sell more in 1 month of all of those models than they did in that entire initial year.
Yep. And they have a list here of the 19 retailers that make up the original Range Rover North America Charter Group, which, leave it to Land Rover to give a nice name to it, Charter Group. A couple here stand out to me, at least the Land Rover Buckhead, which is in Atlanta. The Disco that I had, Disco 2 that I had, had a Buckhead tire cover, because that's where it came from. And so, you know, it's good to see that there's a couple others here. Cherry Hill, Albuquerque, Portland, Nashville. My favorite name, Dimmit Land Rover, which sounds like damn it, but you know, I'm sure that happens. Moving along, Land Rover launches an off-road competition for U.S. drivers. Now, you've missed your opportunity. They had four events where you could audition, in a way, I think it's what it is, for a slot with the Land Rover Experience Tour Peru 2017. They're going to take a pair of people twice, once in October and then once in November down to Peru. I guess they're doing this long journey, and they're going to have two sections where they have winners come to these sections. I think one's at least 500 miles they're going to do, and the other's 400 miles. And so you have four chances here in the U.S. You've missed one at the Overland Expo show, which was a couple weeks ago in Arizona. But then the three winners will be selected from trials conducted at their Land Rover Experience schools in California, Vermont, and North Carolina. Morgan, you got a chance. It's nearby. It's in your home state.
I know. It's not that far away to go down to Manchester, Vermont, and go to the driving school.
Why not? Hey, you know, you need to do something for the show. You know, it could help out, you know, the little show thing, you know. You need...
Hey, if I could go to Peru, that would be awesome.
What's not clear on this is, will they supply the vehicle in Peru? That's, you know, what are they looking, and also what they're looking for? Is it someone, are they looking for experienced people, inexperienced people, mid-range people? That was kind of unclear what exactly they're looking for.
It definitely sounds like this is an actual competition that you have to win at each location. So it's like a competition where they have precision and timing and speed on that you have to sort of master all of those and actually win at each location. So I think they're looking for experienced drivers. Because they're definitely providing the vehicles for the Peru portion, but I don't know about on their training courses, whether you can bring your own vehicle and mash through the course as fast as you want, or whether they're going to hand you over the keys to probably at this point an LR4 and go through, or a Range Rover.
No, I wouldn't be surprised that are new Discos. Come on.
But they're not here yet.
They're not here yet, but they are going to be here, and that's a good sales opportunity, is it not?
That's true. That is very true.
And, you know, they can get now, their pick of the production, you know.
Yeah. Well, maybe the actual Peru trip is in the Disco 5. That would be cool. And that would make a lot of sense because they've done that with all sorts of other releases. In fact, the Discovery 2, when that was released, they did a whole round the world trip in the Discovery 2 to show up in, was it LA or New York? I think it was New York for the introduction.
Right. Side note, I'm so glad this is not a video podcast. That's all I'm going to say. You have, starting June 1, you can sign up for one of the trial spots at one of the Land Rover Experience Centers. Maybe also one in Canada, because it says here in this article that you can visit their website by contacting one of the U.S. or Canadian driving schools. So come on, Morgan, let's go. It's a little prodding. Maybe you can at least look into it, huh?
Yeah, definitely.
Next, we'll talk about a Defender. This is a new book is coming out. It's the definitive book of Land Rover Defender. It's called Icon. And this is produced by Land Rover itself, the Bible of Land Rover books, called Icon, the official story of the series Land Rover and Defender. It's being produced to commemorate 69 years since the very first unveiling of the original Land Rover at the Amsterdam Motor Show back in 1948. It's 200 pages, 10 chapters, jam-packed with, quote, painstakingly researched, unquote, Defender information, some exclusive interviews, talk to Jerry McGovern, they talk to Nick Rogers, who's executive director of product engineering. They also talk to Richard Hammond. He does the foreword.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. The foreword is by...
And Bear Grylls is in it, and Ralph Lauren is in it. So this is the time. We have very little power on this show. We just are a bunch of guys, not in a garage. I'm in a basement and talking about Land Rovers.
I'm in an attic.
You're in an attic, but the book doesn't come out till July. Maybe if someone out there who has some connections, maybe could get us an early copy or two so we could look at it. That'd be pretty cool. I'm just, you know, maybe the Land Rover gods will smile upon us and provide us with it. I'll pay for it. I just like an early copy. That's not to be free. I'll pay for it because it looks pretty cool book.
Yeah, it looks very cool. Lots of interesting facts in it and absolutely gorgeous photos.
Yes. Of course, we'll have a link to it in the show notes. There's a magazine, online magazine out of Australia that has a link to it. And I think I've seen it in Amazon. Like, you can pre-order it on Amazon.
Yeah, and you can order it online, or you can also pick it up at the Land Rover, the JLR dealers, and at the Land Rover Experience driving centers.
Well, see, now you have another reason to go to the driving school.
I know.
See
if I can do one in July and go down and do the competition and buy my book.
Get a book. But if there's someone out there who listens to the show who can get us an advance copy, we would not say no. Okay. I should move on. I am not trying to use our special powers for bad. I should only use them for good. Not that we have any special powers, because I don't think we do. Road and Track had a nice little video. I don't know why I said little, but nice video. It's called The Charming Capability of a Classic Range Rover. Admittedly, this is not it's not focused on the Range Rover. Range Rover is a part of this. It's about a couple cousins who import vehicles from Europe, and it's mainly a kind of a sales ad for them. You know, that's the new way of doing marketing these days, with these embedded, you know, reviews and things. It's nice. It is, in fact, a charming video. They talk nicely about the Range Rovers and importing them mainly from Spain. And I thought it was interesting. They noted in there that the younger folks don't want to work on the car. They don't have the time, or I guess maybe the inclination. They just want to, you know, they'll do the oil changes and such, but they help to get the car ready so that it's at that point where they can just run it like a modern car.
Imagine that.
It's a nice little video. It's, you know, 15 minutes. It is, in fact, charming, and nice pictures. And I wish I had their budget for a second film crew to take with me on my trips so I can have the sweeping picture of my Defender on a bridge going over a large gorge when the drone flies over. Yeah, I'd love to have that production value. Absolutely. See if we can make that happen.
Yeah, we're going to have to become a video podcast if that happens.
For that one time. For just that one time.
For the one time.
Yeah, well, special video for that. All right, I'll give you that.
You guys don't need to see us every month.
No, not at all. It's funny, I do have people who say to me, oh, you have a podcast. Yes, yes. Oh, is that a video? And I'm like, no, it's not. Is it live? No, it's not live either. There's another good thing, as you probably saw me tweet this past week while I was editing the interviews. I'm so glad I edit the show, because all the things I do that I cut out, and other people do too, that cut out, that just don't sound good.
It's important.
Yes, I mean,
all the good podcasts are, all the really great podcasts are well produced.
That doesn't mean we're great podcasts. It just means we're produced.
Right. Yeah, I'm not.
Rare Harrods Range Rover on auction. So out of Atlantic British had a nice post.
Yes, it's a very interesting looking Range Rover, the Harrods edition. Very cool. I think it was originally sold for around 38,000 pounds. So I think that's around 113,000 pounds at this point or something. So, you know, cost less than a home back then and now is going quite high. Actually, let me double check my numbers here. I totally lost my place.
That's right. Thanks for taking over because I had a cough.
No problem. Yeah, it's about 114,000 pounds in today's money, and it's expected to fetch around 30,000 to 37,000 pounds. So almost the original price. It obviously not accounting for inflation, but still pretty impressive. Very cool. Lots of nice new features and an average of less than 1,000 miles a year since 1983. So it'll be very cool to see what that has gone for because I think the auction was on the 20th at Ascot Racecourse in Berkshire. Somebody bought it, I assume. So we'll see. Good. Very cool, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's good to keep old Land Rovers on the road.
Absolutely.
And to close out the news, I did some research as you were talking. Looks like the new Disco 5 does not have a diesel here in the U.S. because I only see the 3-liter petrol automatic.
Yeah, I think it's coming, but I don't think it's here for the initial year release.
And that's the news for May of 2017 in the Land Rover world. Coming up here shortly. Well, shortly, meaning right after this little break, we're going to have two interviews for you. Our guests this month are from Texas Rovers, the Texas Rovers Club. First up is going to be Chris and Kevin. They're going to talk about the club itself and talk about the SCAR event. Second will be immediately following that one will be Sarah and Laura. Laura's been on the show before. And they're going to talk about Barber Toy and the tribute run. A couple mentions for you. I talk about the Compass class in the interview, which we recorded this right before the Compass class. And the Compass class was really cool. Bill Burke did that, and it was a really, really cool class. I'm glad I did it. And in fact, you got a free compass out of it, which is pretty cool. Know how to use it now. Not sure if I ever need to. I certainly have that ability. So if you haven't taken a compass class, I recommend it. And also, I never did get to ride the trails in Sarah's disco. You'll hear all about it in the interview. She has a really cool kick-ass disco. Unfortunately, just things to happen. I couldn't do that. Interviews are coming up here in just a moment. We are not going to have an M-Word or Heritage segment this month because people are busy, things going on, and it looks like the show's going to run almost 2 hours anyways. Let's get on with it. Interviews coming up next. Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast. Continue to be in Gilmer, Texas for the SCAR event. Gilmer, Texas is about 2.5 hours northeast of Dallas-Fort Worth, right? Does that sound about right? I'm sitting in a conference room they have here on site at the Barnwell Recreation Area, talking to the president and the treasurer of the Texas Rovers, Christopher and Kevin. We're going to talk about the club and we're going to talk about SCAR and how that came about. So the Texas Rovers started in 1995, and then the SCAR event didn't happen until 2004. So Kevin, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about the beginning of the club.
I became a member in 2000, so really what I know about it picked up from that time, but in 95, I think the only people who were really wheeling their trucks or doing expeditions or traveling around were people who had the first D90s in 95, 94, and probably 110 or two that were around then also. Really don't know much of what they were doing because I joined the club in 2000 after I bought Range Rover Classic. I think Christopher and the group with Ross Mabee had just restarted the club, and the first meetings I went to, there were mostly discoveries there, so it was like the discovery chapter had started, and it was a little more unusual having a Range Rover Classic that was starting to wheel at that time. That was kind of the beginning of the club, and became treasurer a couple years later and held that position ever since.
You literally bleed green, oval and money. Okay, that was a bad joke. I had to get that in. Yeah, sorry. And also joining me is Christopher, who's the president of Texas Rovers. And I asked you to give us a background on the beginning of SCAR, where the name came from, what it means, and how the event got started.
Thanks, John, and welcome to Texas. Yes, the club, as Kevin said, was reformed in 2000. Sales associate that worked for one of the Land Rover dealerships, Ross Mabee, was extremely instrumental in getting the club started. And as Kevin said, both of us joined in 2000. About 2004, we went to a club meeting and Ross announced that he was planning to hold an event, getting all the Land Rovers out to a off-road park here at Gilmer. And we all sat there and thought, oh, that's pretty cool. And I wonder what sort of organization we would have to prepare over the oncoming year to get the event off the ground when he announced that he had set the date for 6 weeks hence. So there was much panic. And in 2004, in April, where we traditionally hold the event, about 20 members turned up, and we held our first event. We had no organized campsite. It was just a bunch of Land Rover owners getting together and doing what, you know, what the vehicle's meant to do. Interesting thing is, we had a gale blew through. We had 60 mile an hour winds, and everybody got drenched. Lots of mud. Really, really interesting event. And traditionally, every Scar for the last 13 years has had rain, as I look out the window and I see it starting to rain yet again.
Yes, I can attest there is, it's a factor rain event. I know you guys prepared me for that too, to be prepared for rain, and it did in fact happen. Although I did get back to, thanks to Kevin, I got back to my cabin just before the rain came down last night, which was nice actually that it rained overnight, not during the day. But that does change trails, as everybody knows. And so that'll be interesting to see how the trails have changed. So what does SCAR mean, by the way?
SCAR stands for South Central Area Rover Rally. It's a wonderful title that Ross came up with. Unfortunately, Ross, very, very instrumental in setting up the club, passed away at a very, very early age from brain cancer. And as a mark of respect for him getting the club off the ground, we've renamed our campsite out here at Barnwell Camp Maybe.
It's very nice. Yeah, I went to, when I first showed up, I thought Camp Maybe was M-A-Y-B-E. It's not. I was like, is it Maybe Camp? Yeah. Turns out it's in honor of your friend. So you also have a lot of sub-chapters and clubs throughout Texas. Texas, of course, big place. Takes, 10 hours or so to transit it, probably 13 in a series truck, or maybe 3 days in a series truck. but I think you have a lot of sub-chapters. Can you talk a little bit about those?
So at DFW, Dallas-Fort Worth area, is our kind of original and the largest group chapter. In later years, I don't know exactly what year they started, but we started to get more interest from people in Austin, San Antonio. And so they kind of banded together and a group there. And then a couple of years ago, we call it the Woodlands Chapter, which is a suburb area north of Houston. So it really is kind of the Houston area. And then we also have a fair number of out-of-state members. Someone in South Africa, we got somebody in Switzerland, and then some other foreign states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York.
So what do you get for membership? Like, I know you have other events too, in addition to SCAR. So what are the benefits?
So for membership, we have a T-shirt, and you get discounts at some of the local Land Rover service, some of the independent repair shops, and some of the vendors also. I've mentioned you're a Texas Rovers member, we'll give a discount. One of the big events people like in the fall, the State Fair of Texas is in Dallas, and they have a classic car corral. So we get one of the days for the fair, and people get to drive their vehicles and park right there at the fairgrounds, free admission, free parking. And people can come and see those trucks that way.
That sounds like a cool event. You know, and anytime you can pull right into somewhere and you get free parking and like, hey, look at my truck. You know, I'm sure it's pretty cool.
Yes, it's always very, very well attended, you know. And we have a simple rule. As many people as you can get in your vehicle. So it pays for your membership in one day, you know. And as Kevin said, you get a T-shirt and club decals, which are very sought after and very, very highly prized, and a whole bunch of other stuff and, discounts at various independent Land Rover shops.
Yeah, I've noticed there's a lot of independent shops down here in Texas. There seems to be less, at least where, you know, northeast where I'm from, seems to be less of that. So that's actually really nice that you get discounts for that. I'm not pimping the independent shops. I'm just letting you know that's a nice little benefit to get that. Because, well, I guess the independent shops are also actual Land Rover enthusiasts too. Then they're, and I know many of them are here, and they're, you know, they bring their whole staff and spend the weekend here. So it's that's a good benefit. So you have SCAR and you did State Fair. I think you guys have some technical events, and you also just come out to Barnwell here pretty often. Are there other places you go to off-road?
Yeah, there's actually in different directions. So in the summertime, in July and August, when it's 100 degrees here, Colorado is a very popular place to go. Several people have taken trips there. Some we've organized as the club, and a lot of people just go and take their families or have independent trips. Moving in Oklahoma, in southeastern Oklahoma, Clayton area, there's a big wilderness management park that has a lot of roads and some private wheeling area there's, but also good for families because there's kayaking, fishing, hunting during the season, people like that. Going kind of the opposite direction down to Big Bend area, it's a huge national park, and there's also a state Big Bend State Park Ranch that's down in that area, and that takes 6 to 8 hours to get to from Dallas. And then once you're there, there's no cell phone service. It's pretty remote. It's a great, high desert country isolation to see. I guess in the future you could see the wall being built down there. Then closer, I think Joey Pitts in our club lives near Bridgeport, and there's a small kind of a, I don't know if that's private or...
It's financed by the city.
Yeah, so I haven't personally been there, but a lot of people out that direction is fairly close. So Texas is a big state, but we got a few areas like that to go.
And one of your chapters also has the Highlands, the Woodlands events, and that's another. That's the Austin chapter. And they put on another event too. That sounds pretty interesting. I know they brought a whole contingent of folks up off road. I got to ride with the wife of the gentleman who owns a Defender, and it was pretty cool. That was fun. But I know they brought other stuff up. Back to you, Christopher. How has the SCAR changed over the years and the time that you've been involved, and things? And where do you is there somewhere you'd like to take the event and change it in some way? I would of course say no, because I think it's a fantastic event, which we discussed last night over a beer or two.
Or two. SCAR started, as I said, in 2004. It was a very, very basic event. It was just a whole bunch of guys just getting together. And then we realized the next year that we needed some form of organization and continued to grow. Interest started. What many of your listeners probably don't know about Texas is there are very, very few places, as Kevin alluded, to legally wheel. Barnwell Mountain, about an hour and a half east of Dallas, and we have a place down in Austin called Hidden Falls. And then, as Kevin already said, Bridgeport. They all offer different levels of amenities. Out here at Barnwell, we've got showers, permanent food truck, cabins that you can rent. Bridgeport, more Jeep orientated, no overnight camping, so it's really for the day run. And then you've got Hidden Falls down in Austin, very scenic park, again somewhat limited facilities. So getting back to SCAR, over the years the numbers have grown. As I said, we started with about 20 vehicles, I think, and Kevin may correct me. I think the registration this year was 120 registered vehicles. We have people from New York. Normally we get a lady, a retired school teacher, who drives down every year from Michigan. We've got people from Pennsylvania, Ohio. I don't know what the thing is. We seem to have a lot of people this year from Pennsylvania. Perhaps the weather's particularly bad up there. And of course, as Kevin said, foreign states, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Oklahoma, we need, and Georgia, yes. And I think we need a wall around Texas to stop these guys coming in. But seriously, we've got tremendous support from our vendors. We now have Friday and Saturday night, two catered meals. So for SCAR, you pay your money. There is obviously a discount for club members. Come in, you get depending when you arrive, but 3-4 nights camping, two meals, an amazing goodie bag. And, I'm throwing it out again to the sponsors. This year we had everybody who registered as a driver got a Yeti, a genuine Yeti tumbler in their bag. As I said, John, over the years, to keep pace, there is a lot more organization. One of the things that we have tried to promote, and it started really last year, we have a movie night and a root beer float for the kids. This year we got 52 kids. we are trying to promote this as a family event. Dad can come and will. Mum can sit with the kids or chill in the campsite. And there's something for the kids. We have a RC challenge. There is a big remote control car track out here, and they have time trials for the kids, and the winner gets to take home a big RC truck. So where's the club? I mean, where's Scar going? I think the club is quite happy with the format. There are a few things. John sat by the fire last night with a few beers and, you know, gave us some pointers on, you know, what we can do to improve. But at the moment, I think Kevin and I and the rest of the team are quite happy with the format we've got. And, you know, if it ain't broken, don't fix it sort of thing. One of the things that we have gating us here is the trails. We had a Barber Toy tribute run, ladies drivers only, and there were 19 ladies turned up driving boyfriend's or husband's car. Lots of varied events. Maybe we'll fine-tune it next year, but we are keeping Ross's memory alive by making the event, hopefully. We don't want to be the biggest. We just want to be the best.
I like that. Well said, sir. That's true. And it is a very well done event. I was impressed. Things were well organized. I will say this: if you're coming to this event, and they say there's a trail starting at 12:30, they're going to get on the trail at 12:30. So make sure you're on time. No rover time where, oh, half hour later, maybe we'll get together and maybe we'll finally get on the trails. I also like, let's talk a little bit more about the trails and the event itself. One of the things I liked is that you actually do an inspection of the vehicle. I think that's something that I've not seen done a lot at other events. Yours is, you do an inspection before every trail run. So if it's not like you get your truck checked out on day one and then you're still wheeling it for the next 3 days without a check, but before every run. So wonder where that came from, if there's any background to that. And tell us more about, you know, the trails themselves, different levels, what, you know, skills are necessary.
Well, this year our trail leaders were led up with Joey Pitts and Arto Pullinen. And Arto's been a club member since 2000. He's originally from Finland, but he's really likes.
He's a Texan now, isn't he?
Yes. He is.
Aren't we all? Yes.
He's a full Texan, and he's got his same 1999 Discovery that he bought new and still wheels it out here. So a couple of things we've done is we've had Bill Burke do some of the last 2 years. He's come out to do some trail leader training for us. So we've got a small group that's been through that both times, and he helped us on some of the, you know, thoughts and the organizations with that. On the vehicle inspections, we set up an area where we might have two groups of beginner level runs, two groups of intermediate levels. There might be a more advanced level, but there are also people who are more advanced are free, just go off and do the trails that they want in their own smaller groups. It gives the trail leader a chance to check out the vehicles behind. They're going to follow and make sure that they're, you know, the driver and the vehicle are capable of what the trails are selected to do. And it's just kind of checking the engine. Are there any warning lights? Or, of course, it's a rover, so you're going to have lights on your dash, but we want to make sure that they aren't just totally serious or going to cause a problem out somewhere. Just checking the brakes, make sure there's no fluid leaks and that your e-brake is really going to hold your vehicle there on the trail. And steering, that you don't have a lot of slop, and again, that the leaks aren't severe, because who doesn't have a leaking steering box on a classic Range Rover or Discovery? We had the trail leader training with Bill Burke, and he's back again for this. He's come, I think last time was 3 years ago, and before that, he's here this year, so he's doing some of the beginner instruction, and he's also very hands-on, right along in the trails. Yesterday afternoon, I was a tail gunner on a group that went through an intermediate trails. Chris Kelly was the leader. And there's one spot that I understand the day before, he was on a point where his front steering rod, track rod bent. And so that led to his wheels being towed out. And as they were working on how to get a trail fix, it ended up with Bill Burke using his onboard welding. They were able to straighten the rod a bit, and then he strengthened it by welding on a piece of angle iron. And so now Chris has a reinforced steering. So he guided me through that same point yesterday afternoon. Everyone else had taken the bypass, but it just showed with some of the trail leadership training that we've had. I had total confidence in Chris, wheeled with him for 15 years or so, and was able to take through. And others were, I think, very impressed how close the vehicle came to some of the sidewalls or the camber that we got on each side with it, the articulation. And really, you know, the vehicle did all the work, and I just followed Chris's instructions and made it look smooth.
How many trails do you have, and do you guys name them, or are they're named by Barnwell, right?
Yeah, there's Barnwell Mountain Recreational Area is about 1,800 acres. There's a main road that goes through the top and goes off in two directions at one intersection. And coming down off of it and back to the main road are a number of trails. I think there might be about 50 total. Some are rated very easy and some are very challenging. And if you have a built buggy or something on 40-inch plus tires or what those are for. Others are more dedicated for dirt bikes or ATVs, and actually too narrow for our vehicles. As far as naming them, we as a club sponsor a couple of trails, so we got naming rights on those. So one of the first ones we did, we called Green Lane, and it was relatively smooth and easy. We kind of hacked it through the trees and down, and with working with the park supervisor at the time, who kind of suggested this area. Over time, with all the rains and washouts of and other big tired vehicles, there are parts that got very rutted and then exposed some of the rock that underlies this here. So places got more challenging. Another one that Houston Club sponsored is called Sully Hole. So another, you tell the names here. We were on Binder Boulevard yesterday, which is really an International Harvester or Scout group. Yeah, so if you adopt the trail and keep it up, you get some naming rights for it.
Excellent. That's really cool. Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a center steer trail just yet. I'm not, yeah, take a little bit of effort working on it. Okay, I'm working on it.
So the trails here are more the East Texas Piney Woods. And it is talking about the different areas we go to where you've got the high desert country and like Big Bend. Go to West Texas and it's fairly flat and, small mesquite trees. Another area I forgot to mention earlier, but we go to is North Padre Island. It's a national seashore, not to be confused with South Padre Island for the spring break time frame. This one you go to near Galveston, and the first area is like 5 miles, and any passenger cars can really go to that. But to go beyond that point, you need four-wheel drive, and you drive right in the area between the water, whether it's high or low tide, and then the dunes, and you can't go on those, but it's about 55 miles that you can go till there's a cut through the island to get to the intercoastal part. And so you can go down there, and we camp, say, around the 37 or 40-mile marker area, and it's totally remote, great fishing. One time we went there, and we did a cleanup. A guy in the club, Jack, had towed another club member's Forward Control 101, towed it behind his disco, so we made several stops to refuel, and he was the slowest one. But that was the only time I've driven that, and it was great driving that on. It was perfect for the beach, and we were able to collect a lot of trash and debris that washes up from the Gulf into this area. As we were going along, we would fill up the bags and put them in the back of the it was a troop carrier, so an open bed that we could put them in, and it was great to haul things out. One of our club members, his wife spotted a piece of plastic and kind of pulled on it, and it came up, and it was about, I don't know, maybe 12 inches square, a few inches thick, just all wrapped up and looked like maybe a contraband that somebody had thrown off of a boat or lost out in the Gulf somewhere coming from South America. So we just kind of put it in the floorboard of the 101 and then went about our business and things. Then the following Monday or Sunday when we came out, we saw a park ranger up there, and we went up and said, "Hey, we found something we think you should have." And they said, "Oh, wait a minute. I think you should have left that there and just given us the coordinates, because this is a kilo you're transporting, and you might have intent to distribute or something." Yeah, right. Well, we thought we were just doing a good deed there.
Things worked out all right?
Yes. Yeah. I think
we're here talking to you.
Okay.
Yep. No members went to federal prison as a result of that incident. We had a great time there.
Well, I guess actually that raises an interesting point. What do you do if you find something like that out? And I guess is get the coordinates and let a police officer or someone know, right?
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that is the home for the Ridley turtle. It's getting a very endangered species. And they tell you that basically if you're driving down and you see any eggs or something, you've got to mark it. And the game wardens patrol that area fairly frequently. Although, as Kevin said, it is absolutely desolate. I mean, it's beautiful. I've done several trips down there at spring break with kids, and there is just nothing for them to do electronically. There are no phones, absolutely, you know, and the batteries ran out on day two. So it's like, what can I do? Well, you can swim, you can fish, you can throw ball, you can go and hunt for shells, fly kites, and it really is amazing. But yeah, and going back to your question, yeah, you're apparently the rule is if you find it, you've got to mark it. Don't touch it, especially with the eggs and the turtles. But it is really a magnificent place to go. I mean, it's just total wilderness.
Yeah, you guys have some great properties and lands down here, just things to see, and clearly you guys are getting out, doing things, and encouraging people to take their trucks and go visit places and do things and help out the environment too, which is always good to clean up. I saw in 60 Minutes recently, there's what, 5 centers of plastic in the oceans, and birds are eating them, fish are eating them, and that's getting to the food supply. That's a whole other podcast, but that's interesting stuff. Do you know fleece is really bad apparently, because all those little fleece, those little bits of plastic from the fleece get out and they get into the food supply. Anyway, we'll move on from that one. Christopher, obviously you're, I don't know if it's obviously, it's obvious to me, but you're British. So how'd you come to the United States? How'd you arrive here? And have you always been a Rover person? Were you a Rover person back in the UK?
Actually, I came on a boat, you know. No, seriously. Dad had a Rover, and he was a naval officer, and he would go overseas, and I would sit in the Landy as a young kid, and I would just sit in the garage, and I would fantasize that I was driving this through Africa and some parts of the world that I hadn't even, you know, sort of knew about, but it was just... And then one day he came home, and a couple of days later, the Landy disappeared, and we had a Renault Dauphine in the garage. And it's like, Dad, you've sold English for French. And I was, but that was that. I had a Range Rover Classic when I worked in England. And then when I came over, I worked for an English company for 25 years, and in 1984. They asked me to come over to set up an operation over here, and I ended up in Chicago. Loved it, absolutely loved it. Spent a couple of years in Chicago, and we bought a distributor down in Longview, Texas, which, believe it or not, is about 30 miles from here. So it was a bit of a cultural change coming from, you know, Chicago to... And I was a bit of a novelty at the time with an English accent in 1987, wandering around Longview. You know, everybody wanted to send me home. But and then I moved the operation to Dallas. And I stayed in Dallas in 1991. I went to a Buick dealer, Don Snell. He was starting to get into Land Rovers. He had 5 classics lined up, and I knew what I wanted, and I had the choice of 5. I think I was his second buyer. I've since bought four or five vehicles from him. And I drove 91, 92. I drove around Dallas, and everybody wondered what a wonderful Toyota I was driving and whatever. And now, of course, you know, in where I live, everybody's got Range Rover Sports and Discoveries. I sold the Classic, and I bought my first, I bought a 2000 D2. Then I had an 02, and now I've got the infamous 4.6 in my 04, which we we all got an extra scan gauge just for the temperature. Because, as Kevin said, I mean, we get 100 and 110 days here, you know, and that is not the best engine to sit in stop start traffic with. So So, yeah, that's a little bit about me. I've got two kids, married a lady from California who's now in Dallas, and I have a child who's going to be a senior at Texas Tech, and my second son is going to be 16 and driving next month.
And what will he be driving? Did you get them properly associated with Land Rovers?
No, I've gone Japanese. You can only have so much leaking oil in your garage. No, seriously. I mean, it's he wanted. I got elder son's got a Scion, and my youngest has got a Maxima Coupe. So, okay. So yeah. I mean, as I said, you can only have so much leaking oil.
I know, but you know, you got to try. You got to try, absolutely. Right? Yeah, yeah. So, your current D2, what have you done to it? I know you did. It doesn't seem like you get to do much trail riding right now because you're running the show.
Scar's not the event that I do trail riding. I've got a snorkel. I've got a safety devices rack for which I use for long trips. Dual battery system, sliders, bigger tires, just the normal stuff, 2-inch lift, just the normal stuff to do the type of terrain that we do. The rack unfortunately stays against the wall in the garage and comes out when I do the Arizona, Utah, whatever. As you've seen, I mean, Discovery is the vehicle of choice really here. There's a lot of stuff that you can buy for it. It's still supported, although it's dying off now. We talked about last night, where's the mark going? I mean, you know, it's Scar in 15 years. What vehicles are we going to see? I mean, it's sometimes I wonder, about the future of the club. Maybe that's for another broadcast.
I know these are things I think and worry about myself. Where's the mark going? Particularly, where's off-roading going? As I've talked to other people about autonomous cars, and yeah, that's going to be fine and wonderful for us because we know how to drive. We can quick and easily jump into a truck and still have a good time. But if there's a generation of folks coming up that they're not going to learn those skills at all. Are they going to want to then go buy an old truck, whether it's a Land Rover or not, challenge themselves on some rocks? And even Land Rover's moving into autonomous off-road, it seems, with all the fun stuff they have. But yes, as you said, maybe kind of continuing conversation we have on the podcast, this is not the first time this has come up.
One of the things is, I mean, you've got an earlier model and it breaks down and you've got a fair chance of, fixing it by the trail. I mean, you get some of these super sports now and if it shuts down, you're not going anywhere.
Yep.
You go down to bump stops or, the engine's immobilized. You've got, reduced performance. Right. Hey, wonderful if you're 500 miles from base and, there's a tow truck in your future.
Yeah, but you're stuck in mud, up to the door sills.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you're in third, it's locked into third gear.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we had, last year, I think we had three or four, Kevin will correct me, Range Rover Sports. We've got one this year, and then she's a club member. We've got two LR4s here and a few LR3s. But, as I said, it's interesting to ponder the future of the club and what are people going to be driving.
Brings up to mind, you're talking about what's here, but what I find interesting is what is not here. And I'm surprised there's not a lot of more series trucks running around. There are a couple, and there was a series one, which was magnificent to see. And there's two, I know of one for control was here, but any sense as to why maybe not a lot of series trucks? Is it more of a East Coast, rest of the country thing?
Well, they're all broken down on the way here. They're all, as we drive home, they'll... No, seriously, we're seeing more than we have traditionally in the past. I think Kevin would concur with this. We just got the real enthusiasts. I mean, it was amazing to have this guy. We drove from Galveston, which is how many miles? 500 miles from here, 400 miles, series. And his wife was in a series, and he was in that F-101. And we were wondering whether who was pulling who, But they got here. I mean, it's amazing. But, yeah, it's something... we see more in our shop, people resurrecting or restoring or paying to restore these vehicles. And I think as we go towards computer-driven vehicles. People are respecting, you know, it's great to have a, you know, a piece of metal sticking out the floor that you can move around and actually get the gear, the car to move, you know.
So, Kevin, let's talk about you. And this, so this is a disco-friendly event. Obviously, there's a lot of discos running around, and I think you have a disco, and I think this is your, and you've also had a Range Rover Classic. So how'd you get into Land Rover? Where did that start? Clearly, you're not British, so you don't have the pedigree.
Yeah, no, unlike Christopher, so I don't have any children, so I can have too much oil. So still have the Range Rover Classic, bought that in 93. Bought that in 2000, probably had that out here for the first six scars or so. Then about 6 years ago or so, bought a Defender 110 North American spec from local shop. And it was originally sold by the dealer here in Dallas, so it's always been in Texas. And have had that out here for the last 5 years. This year I brought, it was a 97 Discovery 1. It had been kind of my airport office car in Atlanta for 10 years. I bought it from a Solaris Club member in Atlanta, and he had used it as a trail truck. So it already had all the dents and scrapes and things, so I didn't have to worry about that. But it's also got ARB front and rear lockers, which are kind of nice for especially being a trail leader or trail gunner to make sure that we're able to maneuver through and help people and not chew up the trails any more than have to be. Daily driver typically has been, I've got a 2004 Range Rover Westminster, which I have not brought off-road, but my wife primarily drives that one.
So how did it all start? Where did you get the bug?
I think the first Range Rover Classic I rode in was we had a project in Kuwait, and there was a project manager there who had one. That was a really great ride. I had a Toyota Land Cruiser FJ60 at the time. It was an 88-year model. Leaf springs versus coil springs. The Toyota had a 4-liter inline six, great torque, but heavy and, you know, very slow and hard to accelerate on the freeways and things. It's all relative, but the Range Rover Classic was, with the 3.9, was much more so. And so that even now, I think, you know, the Range Rover Westminster's got the BMW engine. It feels fast. I just don't want to try a supercharge because then that would spoil even more. So I've enjoyed them, and keeping with the same vehicles, some things have done at the independent shops for work, like major engine overhauls, but other things, that's parts or accessories or basic maintenance or repairs, try to do that. And by having three older ones that are more or less similar, learn, and you can keep one on the blocks and the others running. Yeah.
I am a bit upset with you. You didn't bring the 110.
You should have been here last year. It did buy it and did wheel with it out here. So it's, doesn't just always sit in the garage. But last month, somebody had contacted the club. Joey Pitts referred him to me, and it was a groom to be who was, he had two tasks for the wedding day, which was about 2 weeks ago. One was show up, and the second one was to arrange the getaway vehicle. And he always liked Land Rovers. And so we made a deal where I would drive the 110 for him. And so charge him enough, which let me to have it completely cleaned and detailed, which is the first time it's had that in the 6 years I've owned it. So now it's clean. I think I'm going to take it to a All British Car Show Day. That'd be April 30th. It's clean for that. Do have one thing, though. As we were waiting for them to come down from the reception, there was another couple that came out, and they had ordered an Uber, and they were standing there, and they were from out of town. They didn't know quite where they were. I could hear them on the phone trying to talk to the driver of where they were. They had the address. And at one point, they said, well, we're standing by this white Jeep thing here. But that's what she was saying there. But he corrected her. He says, no, it's the Land Cruiser.
That's good story. So, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for hosting me here at Barnwell Mountain Recreation Area for the SCAR event. I'm trying to get all that right. And thanks for coming on the show today and talking about your trucks and talking about SCAR and Texas Rovers. You can find Texas Rovers at texasrovers.com or .org, I find out. And if you're interested in attending SCAR, you know, check out their website. You can also go to Facebook. There's a whole SCAR page there. I do believe you need to be approved to join. But once you get there, you can see all the pictures and they give you all the information, how to register when that comes up. It's a fantastic event. If you're a Land Rover person, it's a really nice place to be. Not been to all the events across the country, but I will say this now, it's the best event in the country. How's that?
Thank you. That's good to hear. No, we are very glad to have you and appreciate you showing up and able to see what we have here in Texas. And I hope you're able to come again sometime.
Absolutely. Just as Kevin said, thanks so much for coming. Appreciated the insight last night. And open invitation to any of your listeners who want to make our next event. You got all the information. John has given you all the information on how to get hold of us. We would love to have you, especially from states that we traditionally don't get people. So come on down, and as they say in Texas, give us a holler. And we're fixing to – see, I have to struggle with this, you see. I can't even say – you know, so – no, seriously. Just come on – you know, seriously, come on down, and we will make you very welcome. And if you need more details on the club, Texas Rovers, www.texasrovers.org, or as all the young people do these days, go to Facebook. Or – do we have a – we don't have a Twitter account, do we? I hope not. No, thank goodness. Scar obviously will be full of pictures for the event, and then that will die off. So Facebook will be the one to find out what we're doing. And once again, John, thank you so much for having us and for you coming down here.
Welcome back to the Sinister Podcast. I'm still in Gilmer, Texas for the SCAR 2017 event. Joined now by Sarah and Laura. Sarah is a Texas Rovers member. She's one of the trail leaders and sponsor coordinator. And she has a kick-ass disco that we're going to talk about later. And so one of the reasons I have her on the show, of course, and you found out about this truck. It's fantastic. It's a nice disco. We'll talk about that in a minute or a few minutes towards the end. You got to stay around and listen for that. And also again, joined by Laura. Welcome back to the show, Laura. She's the SCAR events coordinator, manager, project manager, all around person who does everything for SCAR. If it happens, Laura's involved in it and gets it done. And a personal thank you for hosting me, I guess, and getting me down here and taking care of all my needs for the event, staying in that cabin. Well done, that cabin. It's saved me, let me tell you. Yeah, there was a storm came through last night, from what I was told. Apparently, I fell asleep pretty quickly, and the storm came through. I woke up, and it was 20 degrees cooler. So I'd heard nothing about that storm, thanks to the cabin. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, John. It's great to be on the show.
Thank you, John, for having us back.
Ladies are quite welcome. Thanks very much. And so I specifically want to learn about the Barber Toy Run. Sarah actually led the Barber Toy Run this year. So, Sarah, tell us about what the Barber Toy Run is, where it came from, and I have to admit, who is Barber Toy?
The idea of the Barber Toy came about actually a few years ago when I had a Land Rover Series 109, and I wanted to give her a nice British name. And so I started doing some research, and as I did that research, I came across the story of Barber Toy, and I think it was on a Land Rover page, and I was quite fascinated with her story. She was a lady that was a playwright back in the late 1940s on a bet from someone that said nobody could do something. She said, well, I'm planning to travel across the Sahara, and I'm leaving next month. And she didn't own a truck, and she had never been in a Land Rover or an off-road vehicle. She promptly went out and bought one, named it Pollyanna. And for the next 40 or 50 years, she traveled the world by herself, did her last around-the-world trip at the age of 81, I think. So, you know, I was very interested in her story, and it seemed to be an inspiration to me and to some of the other ladies that I wheeled with. So as we came out here, I was generally one of the few women that got behind the wheel and did a lot of driving. And there was a tendency for men to come up to me and say, you know, wow, it's really great. You wheel with your husband. I wish my wife or my girlfriend would come out. And my response was, if you want her to come out and drive and enjoy these weekends with you, then you need to get her to drive, because it gets very boring being a passenger. And I said, as soon as you get her in the behind the driver's, you know, and she starts driving, you're going to have another problem. It's not that she won't come. You may be struggling to get her to let you drive. Through that progression, Lauren and I decided that it was time for the Texas Rovers to start encouraging women to get behind the wheel. And we came up with the idea of doing the Barber Toy. And we started, last year was our first year. This is our second. It was a great event. And I'm just happy to be here to talk to you about it. We had 18 trucks yesterday, all women drivers. And we did some relatively challenging trails. Some of them had never been behind the wheel, were quite nervous. And we managed to coach them through without, I think we had one slightly cracked rear plastic bumper. So just a good indicator that somebody needed to go ahead and get rid of that bumper and put a real bumper on that on a disco. but it was a great event. And our plan is to expand this. We had 18 trucks. This is a really long group of people, a lot of new drivers and a lot of stopping and coaching. So our plan, we have plans in the work for next year of, you know, expanding it, making smaller groups, doing multiple runs, doing some training expositions and that type of thing, just to get women to be more familiar. I thought it was funny because a lot of this is what I was when I started. As we inspected trucks, I asked somebody to pop their bonnet and they looked at me with a blank stare and said, I have no idea where the bonnet, you know. So I said, well, I can show you, but you're going to do it. You're going to get up and you're going to raise the hood. So, you know, just very empowering to see people that, you know, are used to being told what to do. And we're asking them to now think about what they're doing. Definitely, we're just building confidence through experiences and through the adventures. So we've got a lot of exciting ideas coming up.
So you had 18 trucks, but before you actually went on the run, you had a kind of a driver's meeting, talked about some of the issues to women in particular seem to encounter. Can you maybe give our listeners anyways, a little background on that and what special things, that's the right word, but you know, what's different that women encounter, I guess, trying to get behind the wheel that maybe men don't, or that you see as a difference?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges as a woman in our Land Rover world, and I don't know if this goes out to other makes and Jeeps and that type of thing, but tends to be that women look at this truck as being his truck. And so I think we tend to worry more about, you know, we're going to break something or we're going to scratch it or we're going to have a problem. And so it's very difficult. And I think for a lot of women to make that transition from the passenger seat to the driver's seat because they're worried about that. And it's a high stress level because they don't want to break his truck. I was fortunate with, you know, when I first started wheeling, it was my truck. And my inclination was to tell my husband, you know, you drive. And I had someone, you know, who said, it's your truck, you drive. And so he put me behind there and I got thrown into it. So I was very lucky that way. But I do understand for men and women, it's hard to go from that driver's position to the passenger seat. And we're very cognizant of how tough that is because you no longer have control of the truck. So if you see something coming, you know, and you're worried about it, you know, you can't turn and you've got to count on somebody that's, you know, sitting there and making sure that they're doing it. So we try to be very cognizant of those issues of what's going on and with that dynamic. And that's why one of the reasons we wanted to try to get the guys out of the trucks and let the women just drive so they're not worrying about what he's thinking at that moment. And we did talk a lot about different things you face on the trail, especially for new beginners. You know, even for women, testosterone poisoning, very, very big issue. I think that myself personally, when I started, I was like, oh, I'm the only woman out here. I have to be able to climb that mountain. You know, I've got to go over those rocks because I'm carrying the torch for women. And I don't want people to look at my Land Rover and say the Land Rover can't do it. And I don't want them to think that the woman can't do it. So I really wanted to stress, you know, you don't have anything to prove to anybody. You know, you're just out here to enjoy and learn. And that's what we were wanting them to do, is to learn. And then adrenaline, dealing with adrenaline, because that's a tough one as well. You know, your body's working against you. So just breathe through it. Know that we're going to get you through some type of obstacle. If you get stuck, it's a learning opportunity. It's not, it's not something to be afraid of. And we did have a few women that had never driven and were very, very nervous. And they went through beautifully, beautifully. So we just went down the list of different things, you know, hand position basics, you know, gearing, left foot braking, different styles of driving that would get them better educated. Last year, we managed to get somebody stuck, had a little bit of a recovery. This year, everybody did so well, we didn't get to practice on recovering anything. But the day there's been a lot of rain, I'm sure there might be an opportunity this afternoon.
Well, with 18 trucks, recovery would have, you know, that would have, yeah. And it was, and the heat was brutal too. It was nice enough you guys let me tag along with Becky in a North American Defender D90. She, I was giving her a little coaching. I tried not to say anything, you know, as I was told, which is tough for me not to talk. But it was, she said, stop here. And she go, okay. And I said, move up just a little bit. And then about halfway through, she said, I'm going to get into the shade. I'm like, you're catching on, you know, because the truck was hot, you know, and everything. And they're like, yeah, I was having you get in the shade all the time as best you could. I think everything you said about what you've just told us was true. And I like, even Becky was very hesitant to drive, even though her husband told her, you know, bring it back with a dent in it. He was okay with that and wanted to do that. But she ended up having a really good time. And she even, the one time she got into a pickle, I'm using a Bill Burke term now, she got into a pickle was, I said, oh, I'm going to get out and I'll take some pictures of you as you're coming through this one obstacle, which wasn't really all that challenging. And then all of a sudden, Laura says, she needs help. It was because the just moving the truck a little bit, she got, you know, she got a lot of, got a little off camber and had some issues, but got through it. But that's interesting. Now, as long as there was someone there who gave her some confidence and reassurance that everything's going to be fine, you're not going to tip the truck, you're not going to, you know, you're not going to run into a tree, you know, or anything like that. So, yeah, it was a really good event, really interesting, and it was nice to see. I almost think that maybe next year you're probably going to have even more ladies wanting to go off, and you may not need the special Barber Toy run anymore, and they might just say we're going off roading, you know, not worried about that. But I think it's great to encourage other folks to off road. As I know, I'm talking too much probably, but as I said other times in other places, you know, I worry about the future for anybody off roading at all because this trucks become more automated and so it's good that we're getting more folks to do it and keep going. So what's the future for Barber Toy? I know you're not from Texas, you're from Atlanta. Have you tried to expand this to other clubs, or can other clubs have their own run? And if so, can they contact you? Or,
well, our original plan, and you know, the event started here, so Texas is our sort of banner founding venue. What Laura and I have talked about is if there was interest and there seemed to be a desire, we hope to maybe reach out to other clubs. And since I do, you know, I consider myself a Texas Rovers because I sort of cut my teeth here and learned here, but have moved, you know, onto several different states and do attend other events, East Coast, West Coast. And we'd like to see if there's an interest to expand this to other Land Rover Club events. We think it's a natural progression, and we just would like to see it grow in that manner. Next year, I think we will probably be looking to do more trail runs. We will be dividing them out to maybe just beginners, and then maybe some more advanced drivers, take them on some more travel, some little bit more aggressive or challenging trails. And then we're also planning to start doing some just demonstrations and make them very hands-on. So we want to put women, you know, like, okay, today we want you to get hands-on on, you know, change the tire, pull a winch line, let's do a recovery, let's practice our spotting. Because this is not just about getting everybody better at driving their trucks. We want them to be better at knowing how to drive it themselves, those decisions and determinations on lines and where they're going. But also when there's something that's needed, they're not just a spectator. Because I think that, you know, I found myself being a spectator. And if something happened, I was turning it all over to somebody else. And as I became more educated and knowledgeable and spent more time training with people like Bill Burke, I found out sometimes that those people that I was following, or those people that were doing a recovery, weren't really being safe. And that eventually I sort of figured out that I might be the better the better choice. And I demonstrated that in doing some practice last week, a couple weeks ago in Georgia, was out trying to just put my truck in stuck situations. And in Georgia, a lot of mud, you know, because a lot of rain, just muddy situations. And I had put myself in a position where my tires were so gummed up that I couldn't make a fairly simple climb. And then went out and bought new Cooper tires afterwards and fixed my muffler. I, you know, two Jeeps were mired pretty heavily in front of me, and I took another line out and got stuck and pulled my three recovery gear bags out of the truck. And a Jeep guy, very nice, ran over to me. And as I'm unpacking everything, he says, "Hey, you know, you want me to throw a chain around that and just drag you out of there?" And I smiled on him very nicely and said, "Thank you very much." But I, you know, and he looked down at all the recovery gear I was unpacking. He says, "Oh, I guess you've got that covered." But, you know, I wanted to share, you know, what you're talking about doing it can be fairly dangerous. And, you know, so I just went through the whole process and pulled it out. And that's where I want to see people go. Just be educated, be knowledgeable, and be more hands-on. And I think that's what we're, as club, committed to doing, you know, for all of our members, men and women. The men tend to be the ones that do it. The women listen, but they don't get hands-on. And we're gonna make sure people start to get hands-on.
One of the other things I noticed in talking, especially after all the trail ended, I know a lot of the ladies said, you know, it's their truck now. So I think that was that was really interesting to hear that because they got them that sense of confidence and I think ownership. You know, the lady I was traveling with, I don't think this is anything she wouldn't mind me saying. One of the reasons that she wanted to do this was they have some commonality with her husband so that they could then do things again. And I know, if I'm not mistaken, Laura, are there not folks who are using this, you know, as a couple then to go out and travel to Colorado and do some other, maybe overlanding on their own? And I think that was evidenced by this run.
Yes. One of the reasons we decided to do the Barber Toy Run and to build confidence. One of the expansions of the club is to have ladies do more, even as a team, but to be able to go out there. We have several club members whose spouses travel with them on like overland journeys and things like that. But a lot of them aren't trained to drive. A lot of them don't have the confidence in the vehicle. And some go just as a couple. So one of the thinking was safety. Is that what happens if your husband gets in an incident or something happens to him? You're in the middle of nowhere, have no phone reception. You have to be able to first aid, get him back into the vehicle, be able to drive out of that terrain that you're in. And that was one of the thinking on this, because my company importance is safety. So that's brought my attention to that. And as Sarah said, we kind of forget about the safety of operating a vehicle, going out camping. There's all these things we don't think about. So if you're more aware of your surroundings and feel the confidence you can get yourself out, you're going to be all right instead of panicking over something. So one of the thoughts too is Bill Burke. I had one of my experiences. I want to learn to read, you know, to read a map, also to work with a compass, because I wanted to start doing my own adventures, my own journeys like Barbara Toy. And so I had asked Bill Burke, what book do you recommend? So he told me what book. I mean, I can't think of it on top of my head at the moment, but that's okay. And so I got Bill Burke thinking. He sent me an email and goes, how about a compass class? I said, that would be wonderful, because it's including not just the males and it's not just including the ladies. It's the children. What if you've got kids traveling with just the dad or just the mom? They need to know the safety concerns or how to read a map. You can't depend on your cell phone anymore or your GPS, because a lot of us go into those areas. You're not going to get a reception. So we've added a compass class, which is going to be held today on Saturday. It's going to be taught by Bill Burke. We actually have orienteering maps and compasses, and it's going to be a class that he'll teach basic reading read a map and how to use a compass. And then we'll do an orienteering around the main pavilion of the Barnwell Mountain Park.
Very cool. I have no idea how to use a compass. I know you set it up and it points north, maybe, you know, I'm like, okay. Yeah.
That's not exactly how it works.
And that's not exactly, thank you. It's not exactly how it works, but I've got my phone and it has a GPS. It's the nature of society. You become dependent, but it's good to have those other skills too for when it's not available or just to challenge yourself. We sit all three of our phones out and looking at all things. I'm glad you brought Barbara Toy up again, because you know she did all this, and that's of course the inspiration for the event. And she did this What do you think Barbara Toy would think of this, and how does that play into her life? For, you know, because I know she was, what, wasn't she the first solo, was the first lady to go solo around the world in a vehicle?
And yeah, actually, we believe she may have been the first solo person to go around the world. There may have been one gentleman that did it before her, but I think there's some discrepancy on that, on whether that's true or not. When you ask, what do you think Barbara Toy might think of this? I like to think, well, Barbara never had children and she doesn't have any heirs. We sort of contacted some people that knew her, gentlemen that worked on her truck for her. She actually, Land Rover made her give up her Pollyanna, her original truck, and she was never happy about that. And she went back and found that truck and bought it back and did her last around the world trip in that truck. And the gentleman that worked on it for her, he eventually ended up owning that truck, and we talked to him last year. I'd like to think that she would be pretty happy about the fact that her legacy, you know, is somehow being brought forward again with Land Rover and with women, and that it's recognized. And I hope one day, maybe 30 or 40 years from now, people are going to be talking about Laura and I at SCAR, you know, that we had something to bring that forward. And, you know, and as Laura pointed out, it's not just, you know, it's wonderful to see these women empowered. It's wonderful to see that they've got young girls that rode with them, and they're seeing their moms and their aunts and their family members empowered, and they're going to be empowered and go forward with it as well. And, you know, that next generation that's going to be involved in all of this. So a lot of this is really targeted at, we don't want to lose the sport, and it seems to be being pushed out by many, many, many avenues. A lot of the closed parks are being taken over by ATVs, and we're hearing a lot that, you know, they don't really want the trucks there, and then a lot of public land is being closed down. We're looking to try to catch families and the younger and next generation to let them understand how to keep those lands open so that we can continue to do this. We're also looking to let people understand that, you know, they may enjoy the outdoors, but as they get older, it gets harder to go out and hike 20 miles. Yeah. So learn how to drive a truck and you can still go enjoy all those really beautiful places that are places you can't reach, and a vehicle will take you there. So I'd like to think that Barbara is very happy. I like to think that this is going to go on, you know, beyond us. And
she certainly is a trailblazer, and I know that she's written several books, and I think she blazed a trail in the Middle East, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was an interesting little anecdote.
She loved the desert, did a lot of her travels in the desert, and back in the 1950s, I think it was her second trip, she decided she wanted to go to Jordan, and at that time, women forget that they were not allowed to drive. They were not even allowed to enter the country. So she wrote a letter to the King of Jordan and convinced him to allow her to drive through Jordan. And she also went to meet him and his harem, which I don't think anybody had ever met. You know, they were very secluded and, you know, just not public. So she just had no, you know, she wanted to do something. She figured out how to do it. Just a great story, and 7 books that just documented. And she never really intended to be a travel documentarian. I mean, she was a playwright, which gave her some writing skills, but this was not her intention. But she did write a lot of great stories about her travels. And hopefully people will buy those books, be interested.
So if you're interested in travel on your own, are there any resources if they're not in Texas or can't make it to SCARS, or anything you recommend ladies look into?
I do. There's an organization, the International Four-Wheel Drive Training Association. They certify trainers it's an international, so across the world. So that's a great resource. They have a Facebook page. They have a website. There's some great reading out there. If you just wanted a basic book to read, the Four-Wheeler's Bible has been out there for a long time. A lot of information, technical information about your truck, information about driving skills, and, you know, just across the board, very good basic information. So I would suggest getting a copy of that book. You can find a lot of stuff online. Be very careful, because a lot of it is coming from a source that really, again, is not knowledgeable. So they're giving you their opinion of how to do something, and it may not be the best opinion or the right opinion. So I would look to those people that are certified because they are living up to a standard that's been tried and tested. Bill Burke has several videos. I actually spend a fair amount of time rewatching those videos just because I want to learn the proper techniques and proper way to do things. So that's also a very good source.
So Barber Toy seems to be a trailblazer and we now know that, and actually now there's more than just the Barber Toy Run tribute run that you guys are doing here. There's also the Rebel Rally, which we've had Emily on the show to talk about that. And so that's a good sign that there's more women getting into the area and there's, you know, having some special events just for them to help encourage and give them the confidence. You've told me you actually want to participate in the Rebel Rally. I'm very interested in that. That's actually very cool because you've also got a cool truck along with that. So tell me about, where did you come from and getting into the sport and how'd that happen?
Well, that's a lot of questions there. I started only about 7-8 years ago when I bought my first Discovery and decided I wanted to offer it at my. I mentioned earlier that I had a Series 3 109. Loved the truck, but it was a vehicle out of Kuwait with very low mileage, and I didn't feel comfortable taking it off-roading. And living in Texas at the time, it was extremely hot. So I never off-roaded that truck and decided to sell it. And found a G4 Edition Discovery in Los Angeles and brought that home and immediately wanted to go out and off-road. So the Texas Rovers took me under their wing, took me out, street vehicle, bald tires, drove it home from L.A. directly to the trails. And as they took me out and put me through a little bit of some challenges. When I finished, I said the only thing that was ever going to stop the truck was me, the driver, because they're just incredible vehicles. Long story and a lot of details, but that truck was retired because I lost it in a fire and went on to buy another truck, which was not a G4 Edition truck. It was actually a G4 Challenge truck that we were lucky enough to find in here in the States, and have just continued to, build that truck and rebuild it a couple times. And now I'm interested in taking that G4 Challenge truck, running it in the Rebel. It's very exciting to me to have that opportunity to give that truck that continued heritage. So I have a friend that approached me. She drives a Jeep. Her name is Jo Marie Fetchy. And Jo Marie is really an interesting person. She sounds to me as if she is a modern day Barber Toy. She's actually in Algeria right now. And she is planning a cross the Sahara drive that she wants to do on her own in a Jeep. And she's in an area right now where it's not been mapped, and she is actually mapping that area currently. So I thought it was just sort of serendipitous that someone that reminds me of Barber Toy contacts me because she wants me to be a team member for the Rebel Rally. So we're in discussions about doing that and doing it in my Land Rover, sort of a Jeep meets Land Rover type thing. We're going to see how that goes, if we can get past any of those issues. And we hope to do that event this October.
That soon. Yes. That's impressive. You know, Jeeps and Land Rovers are cousins after all.
That's true. Joe's obviously got a real history with mapping and compass work. So she would be the person that would be our navigator, and I would be the driver. And we hope to do both Land Rover and Jeep proud and maybe come out and place well with that event. She has actually done the Gazelle event. She did it several years ago, and she did the Rebel last year. So she's really would be a great partner. And we're just hoping that we can get all those details pulled together and get my truck out there. And one of the reasons I really want to do it, because of the history of my Disco, which you.
I'm very excited about.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Because your disco is a press truck, I think, for actual G4 Challenge. Admittedly, it wasn't in the challenge itself, but it was a press truck. Close enough. Still cool. It's also a right-hand drive. Cool. And I got to drive it for all of 50 feet, and I was very excited by that. Thank you. It was wonderful.
Out there on the trails now.
Okay. Let's leave right now. I'm going to go. But what needs to be done to the truck to do the Rebel Rally? Is it ready to go? Is there anything more that you would need to do? And your role would be, of course, it sounds like as a driver, are you ready?
The Rebel is based on the Gazelle, and the Gazelle is a very intense sort of go point A to point B, get there as quick as you can. Doesn't matter what you do to your truck, just don't get lost in another country where you're probably going to be taken prisoner. And you know, so it, very intense and different event than what I've been told the Rebel is. The Rebel, a lot of forest service roads until you get into the serious desert driving. And so I would be working on just some practice on dunes driving, which I have not done much of in the past. And if you go to the Rebel website, they've got some great pictures posted. Last year's event, they did have a couple incidences with two trucks, one that went over a dune and sort of head first down, nobody hurt, and then another that sort of rolled. Almost the very last portion, you know, and more of a getting late and just not seeing, being able to see, you know, and just sort of a little rollout. So, that would be something I would be working on. My skill set needs to be improved. I am actually working on training for certification for the International Four-Wheel Drive Training Association. Next month in Moab, I'm going out to take a class, and they'll be testing at the end of the class, and I'm hoping to be certified as a trainer so that I would be able to go out and be recognized as one of these people that have met that standard. So hopefully that will be something that, you know, is successful. My truck, we have been doing a lot of what a lot of people do, and that's put stuff on your truck and then decide it's not exactly the right equipment, then going back and having to replace it. So we just actually put a different bumper on. We were running with an ARB bumper, and, you know, as most of us know, they're great on the highway. You know, crush cans are great, but you can't pull on them, at least the older style, you can't pull on them, and it really limits your access or climb. So we've replaced that. We replaced a winch to a larger winch. Been buying extreme amounts of recovery gear. I'm now downsizing all of the comfort for my sleeping arrangements in tents so that I have more room for the third or fourth recovery bag that I've got in the truck. It's always changing. It's always fun. I think for the Rebel, the only thing I would really need to add is a second set of MaxTrax, because I've seen where you'll need four. Yeah, two's not going to do it. Yeah, right. So, I just put new Cooper tires on it. Really happy with the performance on them. I'm thinking that I'm pretty trail ready to go do this event, and we hope to maybe place and do well in it.
Are there places that you can go in your area to test? Do you go out every weekend and practice?
Well, you're from the East Coast and I'm from the East Coast. So lived in Florida for a while, did a fair amount of going out to the Everglades, very different style of off-roading than what I was used to. Basically, you swim. And what we found was you drive through water and you go home and you strip the entire truck down to bare metal so that you can dry everything out. Then you put it back together and you go out again. So we sort of got over the whole, you know, doing the water crossings. And a lot of people we wheeled with, they just stripped everything out and just left it that way. But we like to have our vehicle as a possible daily driver. And then in Georgia, you know, we see so many areas that are being closed down. So our closest park is maybe 3-4 hours away in Knoxville, Tennessee. Nice little park. We go up there on occasion. Uwari, you know, another location that we go to. But we tend to you know, save up our time and we head west. We plan to hopefully do the Ducey Urshem this year. We're trying to convince Bill to, you know, put a trip together for us on the Ducey Urshem. We were interested in the Rubicon, but everybody tells us the Ducey is much less traveled, much more scenic, and probably more challenging. If everything falls into place, I would do the Ducey Urshem in September, leave the truck out there, and do the Gazelle in October. And so we're also planning, I think Laura might have mentioned, we're heading over to Switzerland to do some off-roading with the Land Rover Swiss Group on their 30th Jubilee. So a sponsor of SCAR has invited us over, and we're going to go drive his Defenders. So we're really excited about driving Defenders in the Alps. So it's a wonderful small world of Land Rover owners. It really is. Absolutely. They are everywhere, and they identify with you, and you know, just a very, very great group of people.
Well, I'll tell you right now, the Center Steer podcast will be sponsoring you for the Rebel Rally. I don't know how much, but we're going to be some sort of level sponsorship. Awesome. I've decided. So that's right here and right now.
I don't know if I really talked enough about my vehicle. I know you're very excited. I want to get you out there in a little while, and we'll go run some trails. Or I'll even give you the keys, and you can go, because I think I'm going to the Compass class. Okay. I need to get my Compass work, because it's a component of my I-4W DTA training. So I may just hand you the keys and let you go.
Tell me more about the International Four-Wheel Driving Training Association. Like, what do you get out of that? What does that entail? And how long does it take to get that? I think Bill told me that it's a peer review program.
So my best understanding is they tend to do by invitation or by just, you know, if you're in the industry and you apply. So you need to actually be able to provide to them some history of adult education. So they want to know, the organization's not really a four-wheel drive organization. It's a training organization. It's a teaching organization. So they want to know that you can teach effectively. And a lot of people have a lot of knowledge, but they're not really very good at teaching. And so you need to be able to provide that bio to them that you have some history of at least a few years of history of training in some type. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in four-wheel drive. It can be in other arenas. And you're right, it is a peer review. This particular training course that we're going to in Moab, there's going to be 24 people present. I think there's 8 candidates. I don't know if all the rest of those people are actual trainers, but that's a little intimidating if they are. But so you show up, it's a 6-day class. They spend time in the class and they spend time on the trail. And it's basically 10 modules that they're testing on for different skill sets. And it's driving, recovery, map and compass, also mechanical, which is the one area that I'm feeling a little challenged in, because it's not just mechanical. I mean, I'm fairly comfortable with Land Rover, but I need to have knowledge of Jeep and Toyota and modern trucks and old trucks. And so, you know, basically they're wanting that to test that you have that ability. And it was very interesting because of being with Bill on the trails, he's thrown a couple things at me that, you know, sort of he's driving a very cool Defender that's a manual. And as I'm spotting him up a trail, he stalls the truck and says, "Hey, what do I do?" You know, and he throws his hands and his feet off of everything and says, "What do you do?" Yeah, right. And I'm like, "Put your foot on the brake." You know, he says, "Good. Now what do I do?" Yeah. So a lot of information in that way. There's several tread lightly. You know, they're very interested in tread lightly, again, to keep access open, you know, so that we don't kill off the sport. So there's just those different modules that they're making sure that you're proficient. So there's field testing. You'll be out for half a day with an actual trainer that's been certified, and they're putting you through courses to see how you perform. And you're doing demonstrations. So they're going to say to, "Hey, show us how to use a high left jack." And while you're showing us how to use a high left jack, tell us what you're doing and teach that ability. So at the end of it, it's 200 question test that they allow you 6 hours for. some multiple choice and a lot of essay. So, the good part is if you do not pass on the first attempt, you have up to a year to subsequently retest. So, and they do tell you where you might be, you know, less proficient. So it gives you the opportunity to go get better at that. So where I'm going with all of that, I just want to have as much knowledge as I can, because I'm out passing knowledge to people. So I want to make sure that what I'm teaching somebody is the really best known way to do it, right? You know, and then other people have confidence, because as we all know, don't just follow anybody. I used to follow one person that had a sign on the back of his truck that said, "If you can read this, turn me over." And at some point I realized that the reason he had it on there is because he needed to be turned over a lot because his lines were terrible. So I just stopped following his lines and just did my own.
And also by you doing this, you also, I think, encourage other women to get into this, to the sport and into off-roading. And I saw you on the trail, even with the Burper Toy tribute run, you were encouraging women to also spot, and which is important, because, you know, at some point you need to go off and enjoy yourself too, and not always be training and teaching people. So I saw that you were actively encouraging people to get that other knowledge, not just behind the wheel, but out there looking at the line, helping other people, because it's great.
I think one of the things that has really brought me to the attention of needing to build those skills, as I've said before, my tendency was that I was the driver and my husband was the passenger. He took lots of photos, great photographer, and he tended to get out and spot. So we would get to an obstacle and he would be telling me, "Do this." And I wasn't exactly succeeding in getting it done. And usually it got to, and most people eventually sort of decide all you really need to do is give it more gas. And so as I'm doing this and I'm giving it more gas, I'm getting closer and closer to the obstacle. And I've decided at that point that we need to do something different. And he's still saying, "You just need to give it more gas." And I would say, "Well, okay, obviously I'm not getting it. Why don't you show me how it should be done?" And by that time, I put the truck in a really much worse place than when we started. And he gets in and he gives it more gas, and we tap something or we bang something. So, we then got to the point where I realized that I just kept putting him in these bad situations where I've gotten into a really bad spot, and then I'm getting out and I'm not being very effective in helping him. So, and I really did learn that, you know, spotting is a skill, and if you don't practice it and learn it, I'm then telling him to get out of bad spots and he's saying, "Well, go spot me." And I was not confident about those spots. So it really is a skill that I want everybody to understand, because everybody in the truck has a job, even if it's just hanging your head out the window and making sure you're going past that rock. You know, everybody should have a job to help get that truck through safely. And we did. We had women out there, and I'm like, "Watch what I'm doing. Here's the line that we're wanting them to take. If you're seeing that she's left or right, you know, do this." And they were getting it, and they were really feeling good about it. So, and they'll take those skills and hopefully help their husbands, or, you know, their husbands will get better as well, because they may not be very good at it either.
Sarah, thanks very much for coming on the show today, talking about the Barber Toy and Barber Toy tribute run, and talking about you going to the Rebel Rally. I think it's very, very cool. And good luck to you in that. And as I said, I will, you know, the podcast is going to sponsor you. I'm not sure how much. It might just be a sticker, but it'll be something. But if anybody out there is listening and wants to sponsor Sarah in the Rebel Rally, I know she would be open to it. Thanks for coming on the show again. Laura was called away for scar business. So thanks, Sarah, for coming on the show, and good luck in the Rebel Rally.
Thank you, John. It's been great. And we really, really, really appreciate you coming down to SCAR. By far, we've been to so many events across this country, and we always come back to this one because it is just an incredible event, and it's just getting better. And we hope to see you back here again next year, hopefully driving, but even be better, get you out there and take you on some of the very challenging trails that we have here. So it's been great talking to you.
And that's the show for May 2017. I want to thank our guests, all four of them, including Chris and Kevin, talking about the Texas Rovers Club and SCAR itself. And thanks to Sarah and Laura for talking about Barbara Toy and the Barbara Toy Run. I highly recommend you go out and check out Barbara Toy. She seems to be really, really interesting human being and interesting things that she's done. And as I said, we will sponsor Sarah in the Rebel rally. Still don't have no idea how or why, but I, you know, right then and there, we're going to help support Sarah with the Rebel rally, which she's planning to do coming this fall, to work that out. And also want to thank Morgan. Thanks to Morgan for joining us on the show as always. And you are the owner operator of seriesparts.com.
That I am. Resource for finding parts suppliers, garages for series Land Rovers. Try to help you keep those vehicles on the road.
Thanks to Harold, who's working on my truck right now, which is, in my mind, more important than the podcast, right?
I would agree with that.
And thanks to the One True Packs for his production support and hopefully making the show sound much, much better. That's the podcast for this month. I hope you enjoyed the show, and thank you for listening. A reminder to visit our website for past shows and the show notes. You can connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and now Instagram. We are on Instagram at Center Steer Podcast. I was going to put a .com there, but there isn't any. It's just Instagram is Center Steer Podcast. I've been posting some pictures periodically. Apparently that's what all the kids do, and all the cool kids are doing it. So we joined in. We're doing the Instagrams. I'd like to hear your feedback on news and topics this month. So those are ways you can connect with us. You can also support the show directly at patreon.com/centersteer if you wish to support us. And we'd love to hear from you also about you or your Land Rover, so feel free to reach out to us. Next month is our interview with Bill Burke. If you do not know who Bill Burke is, I highly recommend you do some digging, do some little Googling, do some searching on the interwebs. Bill Burke, B-U-R-K-E, he is an off-road god, guru. Would you agree?
I would agree.
Bill Burke, fourwheelamerica.com. I think it's BBW4BA, something like that. I should do some research, right? But Bill Burke's fourwheelingamerica.com. He has videos out. He has about off-road and recovery. We don't talk about any of that, though. We talk about Bill Burke. Where did Bill Burke come from? That will be next month. So until then, I ask you to share the show with one other Land Rover owner. Thanks for listening. Wave as we pass by. Oh, yeah. Happens often. It happens often.
I'm sorry. I was bad.
That was perfect.
What's your opinion, Siri?